But we're going to be in Lamentations. And if you need a Bible in which to turn to Lamentations, get your friend Lloyd's attention, and he will deliver one. Lamentations. Companion book to Jeremiah. I actually looked on my shelves. I don't have a single commentary on Jeremiah that doesn't include Lamentations, and I don't have a single commentary on Lamentations that isn't part of a bigger commentary on Jeremiah, which makes sense because although the author of Lamentations is not named, it's generally understood to be Jeremiah for a bunch of different reasons. The first being that the subject matter fits. The author of Lamentations is grieving over all of the same things that Jeremiah has been talking about for the last 52 chapters of Jeremiah. Grieving over the destruction of Jerusalem and especially the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem at the hands of the Babylonians. So the subject matter fits, the style fits. It's a poem of grief, and we read in 2 Chronicles that Jeremiah was the composer of exactly those kinds of poems. And Jeremiah 9 verse 1, you don't have to turn there, but I'll read it for you. Jeremiah 9 verse 1, Jeremiah identifies himself as a weeping prophet. Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. It's that verse and others that give Jeremiah the designation that we know him by, the weeping prophet. So the subject matter fits, the style fits, the language fits. And the verse that I just read is an example of that. I'll read it again. Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. If we then flip over to Lamentations 1, verse 16, for these things I weep, my eye overflows with water, because the comforter who should restore my life is far from me. My children are desolate because the enemy prevailed. And there are numerous other examples exactly like that of very similar or even identical in some cases language. And if you're interested, if you want to get some of the side-by-side verse next to verse comparisons, Jeremiah versus Lamentations, hit me up and I can point you to some resources. But for all of those reasons and more, the authorship of Lamentations was consistently credited by the Jews in biblical times and Old Testament times to Jeremiah. The Talmud out and out declares it. And the Septuagint, interestingly enough, the Septuagint, the translation of the what we would call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, into Greek in the 3rd century BC, actually includes an introduction that reads like this. It came to pass, after Israel had been carried captive and Jerusalem became desolate, that Jeremiah sat weeping and lamented this lamentation over Jerusalem. So the Jewish rabbis and the Jewish scholars were convinced that Jeremiah wrote Lamentations. The early church fathers took their word for it. The early church fathers accepted it without question. Origen in the 3rd century, Jerome in the 4th century asserted. It really wasn't until the 1700s, the 1800s, the Age of Enlightenment, when critics were questioning everything that anybody suggested seriously, any alternate candidate for the authorship of Lamentations. So we're going to assume that it was Jeremiah for our purposes. So what was it that Jeremiah wrote in this book? Well, the title kind of tells us, and we already talked about it a little bit. It's a lament. It's an expression of grief. It's a dirge over the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Lamentations is not universally accepted as the title of the book. Some Hebrew Bibles use a Hebrew word that can mean ah, or how, or alas. In our vernacular, we might say wow as an alternate title of Hebrews. It's debated within, or alternate title of Lamentations among Hebrew scholars. None of which is to suggest that Jeremiah didn't understand what was going on. That alternate title of, ah, or how did this happen? Or alas, look at all of this. None of that is to suggest that Jeremiah didn't have a very good, very concrete understanding of exactly what happened and why. On the contrary, as we make our way through Lamentations, we're going to see the exact same understanding that God imparted to Jeremiah throughout the book that bears his name is going to come out in the verses of these chapters of Lamentation. Namely, King Manasseh and others imported idolatry to Judah. They were consumers of idolatry. They worshipped idols themselves. They institutionalized idolatry. They encouraged others to participate in idol worship. They rewarded false prophets for their idolatry. They condemned true prophets for rejecting idolatry. They refused correction. And part of what we're going to read in Lamentations is acknowledgement of that, repentance. The declaration that God was in fact righteous for doing what he did, destroying the city and the temple in it, and exiling the people from the land in the process, because that was nothing more and nothing less than exactly what God promised to do, dating all the way back to the days of Moses. I'll bless you in obedience, and I will curse you, I will judge you, and ultimately I'll remove you from the land if you persist in your disobedience. But the fact that the judgment is righteous, and they recognize that it's righteous. The fact that the author of Lamentations, Jeremiah, and those that he gives voice to at times will hear the voice of Jerusalem, the voice of the Jewish people, grieving. The fact that they're repenting, the fact that they're grieving, the fact that they're wailing, doesn't mean that they don't recognize the judgment as righteous. So just because something is righteous doesn't mean that we can't experience grief over it. How many times have you seen a courtroom scene where the jury pronounces guilt or the judge pronounces sentence of a defendant and everybody knows that a defendant is guilty, but the family still weeps? They know that the sentence is just. They know that the verdict is righteous. But they still weep. And that's very much what we're going to encounter here in the book of Lamentations. Profound grief. Not only at the outworking of God's judgment, but at the realization, at the awareness that the judgment was necessary because of their hearts. It was their stubborn, rebellious heart, the heart of the Jewish people, that necessitated, that demanded such a judgment. So Jeremiah is going to express this grief, his own and others, in the form of five poems. Lamentation is comprised of five distinct poems, funeral dirges. And they're structured, interestingly enough, as poems and in a manner of Hebrew poetry that we've come across before. They're structured as acrostics. Chapters 1 through 4 are. Chapter 5 a little bit different. Acrostic, each verse begins with a consecutive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. If it were English, it would be the first verse would begin with A, the second verse with B, the third verse with C, and so forth. 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, 22 stanzas in chapters 1 through 3, each verse starting with that particular letter. When we get to chapter 3, it's 22 stanzas of three verses each. That's why chapter 3 has 66 verses total. I think I misspoke there a moment ago. 1, 2, and 4 have 22 verses. Chapter 3 is the odd one. 22 stanzas of three verses each. And then we get to chapter 5 and everything's up for grabs. Because chapter 5 isn't an acrostic at all. The suggestion that some make is that the reason Jeremiah structured it this way, apart from the Holy Spirit inspiring him to, was to try to convey that the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple was complete. It was comprehensive. From A to Z, it all came crashing down, so to speak. Chapter 5 there are some unique design features, but relative to the other four chapters, it's pretty chaotic. And the suggestion is, well, perhaps that's the point, is that after all of the destruction ordained by God, there was nothing left but disorder and disarray and chaos. If you want to get into the structural elements, the infrastructure of these verses, again, grab me and I can point you to some resources. But let's read some Bible. Lamentations chapter 1, verse 1, how lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow is she who is great among the nations. The princess among the provinces has become a slave. And that first word, how, is why in some Hebrew translations the entire book is referred to as how or alas. That's where it's taken from. And it can be taken as a statement or as a question. Some translations render that first part, how does this city sit solitary, sit alone, that was full of people? And the answer is God's judgment. And God's judgment is reflected in three before and after statements. The city was full of power, full of people rather, and now empty. It was full of power, great power, but it now is a widow. It was a princess and now is a slave. She weeps bitterly in the night, verse 2. Her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They've become her enemies. She weeps bitterly in the night. Literally weeping, she weeps. She weeps and she weeps some more. She weeps unceasingly. Why? She was deserted. Judah was deserted by nations that she counted as friends. Leaders, political allies that she thought would rescue her, and idols, at least among some, that were believed to be stronger than the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The word lovers there, among all of her lovers, that evokes familiar language from Jeremiah, right? And without exception in Jeremiah, that points to spiritual adultery, leaving their first love, trusting in everything that God told them not to trust in political alliances, trusting in military power, trusting in false gods, and not depending wholly and completely on the true and living God. Verse 3, Judah has gone into captivity under affliction and hard servitude. She dwells among the nations. She finds no rest. All of her persecutors overtake her in dire straits. That can be translated under affliction or after affliction. New King James renders it one way, NIV and some others render it the other way. I think they both work because in captivity, Judah was under affliction. Captivity only came after she was under affliction, after Babylon laid siege to her for months and months, starving her basically into surrender. So that after affliction, under affliction, those are both true. And in both cases, Judah finds herself dwelling among nations. Wait, I thought that they were taken into exile in Babylon. Yes, but the point is that they were among the Gentiles. Nations here, a synonym for not the Jews. They were no longer in their own land, among their own people, worshiping their own God. They were among the Gentiles. Verse 4, the roads to Zion mourn, because no one comes to the set feasts. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted, and she's in bitterness. So the picture is, instead of the roads being crowded with pilgrims making their way to Jerusalem to worship at the temple, to gather on the holy days where able-bodied men were commanded to worship in Jerusalem. Instead of everybody going, the roads were empty. They were desolate. And the priests weren't there, but the priests in Babylon or on their way to Babylon or having taken refuge out in the land, the priests sigh. Literally, the priests groan. Why? There's no temple. And without temple, they have no role to play. Without the temple, there's no worship. There's no sacrifice. There are none of the things that anchored Judah's spiritual life. Virgins there pictures the complete disruption of society. So many men killed. The society has ripped apart. Marriage, when women outnumber men, marriage is a dream, but perhaps not a reality. Families are ripped apart. So what we have in verse 4 is complete societal degradation. Verse 5, her adversaries have become the master. Her enemies prosper, for the Lord has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. Master there can also be translated head. And the idea is if Judah had obeyed, if Judah had just followed God, she would have been, what one day she will be, she would have been the head of all nations. That was God's plan, still is God's plan. That's ultimately Judah's destiny. But as things stand, in the wake of Babylon's attack, in the wake of God's judgment, for a time, Judah is relegated to being the tail, the bottommost parts, slaves and not the head. Why? Because God will not be mocked. Because Judah heaped up sin upon sin. We read in Zephaniah and elsewhere, they liked sin so much, they set their alarm clocks to get up extra early in the morning so they'd have more time to sin. And there at the end of the verse, her children have gone into captivity, a reminder that there's no such thing as sin that only affects us. That's a lie from the enemy. The enemy tells us, you're only hurting yourself. No one's going to know, nobody's going to care, nobody's going to be affected. And there's no such thing as a sin that doesn't ripple out from us and affect others, especially children. Verse 6, and from the daughter of Zion, all her splendor has departed. Her princes have become like deer that find no pasture, that flee without strength before the pursuer. This is probably a reference to what we read about last week in Jeremiah 52, where Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, fled with his other leaders, only to be captured on the plains of Jericho, trying to probably get to the river, probably weakened because of months upon months of siege. Even the leaders, even the elite, found food scarce. Verse 7, in the days of her affliction and roaming, Jerusalem remembers all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old when her people fell into the hand of the enemy. With no one to help her, the adversaries saw her and mocked at her downfall. So this is another before and after verse. And that phrase, pleasant things, reaches, but we're familiar with that from Jeremiah. And every time it appears in Jeremiah, that reaches back and refers to the promised land, the land flowing of milk and honey, the land that was supposed to have all of the things that God promised when they were still slaves in Egypt. And that's what it should have been. It should have been a place of blessing and prosperity. Instead, because of their disobedience, the promised land became a place of promised judgment. There's also some wordplay in the last line there. The word downfall, it means what it says, but the root word is the same as the Jewish word for Sabbath, Shabbat. The idea, Jewish scholars connect this to the Sabbath year, the sabbatical year that Judah had consistently ignored. Remember at the end of 2 Chronicles, how long is the captivity going to be? 70 years. Why? Because it was for 490 years that Israel had ignored the Sabbath year. So the idea is instead of rest from her labors, instead of the rest that God promised, the rest that God intended with the Sabbath, they would be forced to labor. And there's a suggestion that perhaps the Babylonians mocked them for that. Oh, so now you're going to rest. You weren't resting in the land, but now you're going to rest. I don't know if I quite buy that speculation or not. But the connection between the Sabbath with the Sabbath year, I think, is interesting. Jerusalem has sinned gravely, therefore she's become vile. All those who honored her despise her because they've seen her nakedness. Yes, she sighs and turns away. So So there's a slight shift in focus beginning in verse 8 and continuing for the next four verses. Jeremiah began weeping. He began lamenting why over the condition of Jerusalem. Oh, the destruction. Oh, the devastation. It's almost too much for words. And the fact of that devastation is that it's the result of judgment. But beginning in verse 8, he pivots slightly and he considers the cause, the reason for that judgment. Judah made herself vile. That word is the same word for ceremonially unclean. And made herself vile, made herself unclean, either we could read this in a way that's obvious to all. Everybody could just see it. It was obvious that people could tell. Or, perhaps even worse, she was making it obvious to all. We read earlier about Judah's spiritual adultery, spiritual prostitution. It's possible that verse 8 is saying that Judah made herself a prostitute and wanted everybody to know. She rejoiced in her uncleanness. Verse 9, her uncleanness is in her skirts. She did not consider her destiny. Therefore, her collapse was awesome. She had no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy is exalted. Awesome here refers to something that only God can do. It's awesome in the true sense of the word. And Judah's crying out to God, or Jeremiah, could be either way, crying out to God, my enemies are mocking me. I'm saying, God, help me. And they're saying back to me, God, help me. Where was God when Jerusalem fell? Answer, he was there. The God of judgment is also the God of comfort. Judah chose how she wanted to encounter God, in which mode, judgment or comfort. Verse 10, the adversary has spread his hand over all her pleasant things, for she's seen the nations enter her sanctuary, those whom you commanded not to enter your assembly. So there's an idea here of the Babylonians having their way with Judah in the person or in the personified by the temple. Only the priests could enter the temple at all. Only the high priest could enter the Holy of Holies. But the Babylonians violated Judah, again, personified by the temple. Why did God let that happen? Answer, and we'll read this when we get to Ezekiel, the Shekinah glory by this time had departed the temple. God said, yeah, this isn't a place of worship anymore. There's nothing here for me. So God's presence departed the temple, and when God's presence departed, the Babylonians entered and trampled and plundered and looted and had their way. Verse 11, all her people sigh. They seek bread. They've given their valuables for food to restore life. See, O Lord, and consider, for I'm scorned. Again, verses 8 to 11, Jeremiah is pivoting slightly, looking at the reason for God's judgment. And here we have the effect of it. Verse 10, the effect of it in the temple. Verse 11, the effect of it on the people. God had indeed turned his back on his people for a time. Why? They essentially begged him to. Now, verse 12, we start another section. Verses 8 through 11, that's sort of a subsection, that's sort of a shift of tone. But Lamentations chapter 1, 2, and 3, 22 verses each, they go 11 verses, they go halfway through the Hebrew alphabet on one theme, on one topic, and then the second 11 deal with a different topic. And primarily what's different in the second half of chapter 1 as we cross over to another section, primarily what's different is voice. The first half is mainly Jeremiah talking. There's sometimes where we say, well, is it Jeremiah? Is it Jerusalem? It's Jeremiah echoing what he hears in Jerusalem or from Jerusalem. It's Jeremiah speaking on behalf of the people. But here in the second half, we're going to hear Jerusalem speak. We're going to hear the city's voice, the people's lament. Starting in verse 12, we hear from Jerusalem directly asking, is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Behold and see if there's any sorrow like my sorrow, which has been brought on me, which the Lord has inflicted in the day of his fierce anger. We're suffering here and nobody cares, Jerusalem says. It's suffering like no one's ever experienced. But notice, even as Jerusalem laments, there's no confusion about the cause. You can't get through the verse without them acknowledging it's God's wrath. And people are walking by and either ignoring it or they're tisking and saying, well, you deserve it. You asked for it. Verse 13, from above he sent fire into my bones. Again, there's no confusion about where this is coming from. He sent fire into my bones and it overpowered them. He spread a net for my feet and turned me back. He has made me desolate and faint all of the day. Again, acknowledging God as the source, as the cause of three different effects. Fire and the image of a net that entraps, that ensnares, from which there's no escape. And weakness, disease and hunger have ravaged the people and by extension have ravaged the city. Verse 14, the yoke of my transgressions was bound. So there we have another image. They were woven together by his hands and thrust upon my neck. Remember that image of the yoke familiar to us from Jeremiah. He made my strength fail. The Lord delivered me into the hands of those whom I am not able to withstand. So different effect, but the same cause. It's Jerusalem's own guilt. And God's acknowledgement, God's pronouncement of that guilt. And as a result, they're bound. They're yoked like livestock. Like slaves, which is in fact what they are. Verse 15, the Lord has trampled underfoot all my mighty men in my midst. He's called an assembly against me to crush my young men. The Lord trampled as in a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah. And in Jeremiah, we found ourselves going often to Revelation and seeing that image of a winepress as a visual, as a representation, as a metaphor for God's judgment. Sort of grim here, if you back up to the middle of the verse, he's called an assembly against me. The picture is a religious gathering, a solemn assembly, we read in some other translations. But it's not a religious gathering, it's not a religious feast day in Jerusalem, it's a religious gathering against Jerusalem. God has declared a holy war against his people. The attack by the Babylonians was a religious act ordained by God with horrific results. Now, as we get to the home stretch of this second section, there's a couple more subsections. The first is Jerusalem's confession, and then the last is Jerusalem's plea for help, that God would move against Jerusalem's enemies. There's some debate about where the transition to Jerusalem's confession happens. Some people believe that it happens at verse 16. For these things I weep, my eye overflows with water, because the Comforter who should restore my life is far from me. I can't find a Savior, a Redeemer anywhere. My children are desolate because the enemy prevailed. This could be the beginning of a confession. Jerusalem realizing the state, truly grasping the state that they're in. Again, it's how? What? What? Wow! This happened. This really happened. And that could be the beginning of a confession. Verse 16, for these things I weep. But what are these things? People who say, I don't think we're getting to confession yet, point at the fact we're not clear at what these things are. Is Jerusalem weeping over her sin or over the consequences of her sin? We'll come back to that, but verse 17, either way, nobody cares. Zion spreads out her hands, but no one comforts her. The Lord has commanded concerning Jacob that those around him become his adversaries. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them. Again, this idea of being unclean, something to be shunned, something to be rejected, something to be avoided. But verse 18, the Lord is righteous. For I rebelled against his commandment. Hear now, all peoples, and behold my sorrow. My virgins and my young men have gone into captivity. If the confession didn't start at verse 16, it starts here. And I tend to think it starts here. Disagree with me if you want, we can still be friends. But the reason I think that it clearly begins here is the verse begins with what? Verse begins with God. Because He's our source and He's our standard. And they're acknowledging their rebellion against Him. Up to this point, you can circle back and review it again. But up to this point, there's acknowledgement, yeah, God did this. God ordained this. The Lord made this happen. The Lord brought this enemy against us. The Lord poured out His wrath against us. But now, verse 18, we finally get around to, because we deserved it. Verse 18, the Lord is righteous, for I rebelled against His commandment. And that's why I'm sorrowful. That's why we've gone into captivity. Verse 19, God allowed us to be afflicted because I called for my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and my elders breathed their last in the city while they sought food to restore their life. They starved to death. Why? Because instead of returning to God when He began to afflict us, instead of recognizing God's chastening for what it was, His reminder of who He was and who we were, instead of letting that point us back to His character and His promise that He would continue chastening us until we got the point, we kept looking, our leaders, verse 19, kept looking for human allies. Allies who failed, allies who couldn't deliver. Because people can't cure our sin problem. We talked about that on Sunday, right? Pointed out that America doesn't have a political problem for which there's a political solution. America has a heart problem that requires heart transformation. It's interesting, I was talking to some folks earlier today, it's interesting thinking about some of the folks who used to sit in these chairs, and well, the chairs that we had before these chairs, but people who used to sit among us in this room, who aren't here. And why is that? Why do people fall away? There's probably not just one reason, but an awful lot of them, the people that we were talking about and naming and pausing to pray for, if we look back, they were people who liked Jesus' people and found strength after a fashion in a community of Jesus' people. But they didn't get upstream from Jesus' people to Jesus. They didn't recognize that the community of God wasn't just this special collection of individuals, but it was a collection that God had called and brought together and indwelt. Verse 19, I called for my lovers. I kept looking for a human solution. I kept thinking that the problems that we were experiencing had a horizontal remedy instead of recognizing that the problems of this life and the problems of our lives and the problems of our heart require vertical solutions. See, O Lord, that I'm in distress. My soul is troubled, verse 20. My heart is overturned within me, for I've been very rebellious. Outside, the sword bereaves. At home, it's like death. That's confession. I am where I am, and what's happening is happening to me because of who I am, because of what I've done. But notice there in the middle of the verse, but my heart's overturned. I'm having a change of heart, literally. Heart transformation is happening. There's testimony to it there in verse 20. I get it now. My worship was all wrong. The alignment of my heart was completely backwards. And then we said that the last subsection is a plea for justice that starts in verse 21. They've heard that I sigh, but no one comforts me. All my enemies have heard of my trouble. They're glad that you've done it. Bring on the day that you've announced that they may become like me. Having confessed, having acknowledged their sin, Jerusalem is not saying, okay, God, you got it wrong. God, you gave us judgment when really we deserved mercy. No, they're saying, yeah, we get it now. And we got exactly what we deserved. But God, don't stop with us. Because our enemies are mocking us. God, you were still the apple of your eye, even in our condition. You promised that you'd bless those who blessed Israel and curse those who curse Israel. Verse 21, Jerusalem is saying, get them, God. You judged us, judge them. You punished us, punish them. Let all their wickedness come before you, verse 22. And do to them as you've done to me for all my transgressions. For my sighs are many and my heart is faint. Again, even in pleading for justice, there's the acknowledgement, we deserved what we got. Just make sure other people get what they deserve. Verse 20, my heart is overturned within me, for I've been very rebellious. That's the peak of the chapter right there. And I think that's the key takeaway from the chapter. The importance of confession, real confession. The qualities of a true confession. And what we're reminded of here, verses 18, 19, 20, confession starts with God. Confession starts with confessing who He is and then uses Him as a standard, as a measure, as a metric for comparison of who we are and what we've done. A lot of times we don't even get to confession. On this side of the cross, we think, well, I confess Jesus as my Lord and Savior once. And if that changes, I'll let you know, God. To do that is to focus on the judicial, is to focus on the legal. Yes, we're forgiven. When we confessed that we were sinners and we needed forgiveness and that Jesus dying on the cross purchased that forgiveness, Jesus dying on the cross made that forgiveness possible, yes, judicially, legally, that was settled. But that ignores the relational. Our sin, even today, even on this side of the cross, our sin hurts God. When we sin, we disobey. When we look at right and wrong and say, just one more time, we're defying the Creator of the universe who loved us so much He sent Jesus to die for us. We're saying we don't care enough about you to honor you, to obey you, to follow you. We're saying, in effect, we don't really believe you when you say that your way is better. Yes, Jesus died for our guilt, but there's still relationship to address. So when we get around to addressing it, where do we start? A lot of times we limp that one into to the finish line too, right? So God, I'm here, I'm in this place, I'm in this situation. Here I am in this condition. And I don't really like it here. I get it, you're punishing me, you made your point. And I'm sorry, okay? So can you just, you know, ease up, make things better? That's not a confession. Because you know, underlying that is are the consequences. God, I don't like what you're doing here, so I'm gonna say I'm sorry so that you'll stop doing what you're doing. And it almost comes with an underlying assumption, God, you're being unreasonable. I get it, you're God, and you get to decide what's right and wrong, but aren't you overreacting a little bit here? You made the rule, you need to enforce it, so fine. I'll say I'm sorry, you say okay, and we can both move on. Come on, a lot of you are parents. And those who aren't, you have friends. That's not how you repair a relationship. Sometimes we deal with God and we forget everything that we know about dealing with people. God's a person. And we need to treat him like a person. And when we mess up, we need to go to him like a person. A couple Sundays ago, we had a hymn sing Sunday. I got a lot of good feedback. We'll do it again sometime. And after the message, we sang Amazing Grace. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound, that saved what? A wretch like me. I was a wretch. I was a sinner. I was a rebel. I was wicked. I was wrong. That's how reconciliation starts. With God, just like with people. I was wrong. Some of the best parenting advice I ever got: don't teach your children to say, I'm sorry. Teach them to say, I was wrong. I'm sorry is cheap. I was wrong, that's bigger. I was wrong, God, and you were good. The whole time you were good, and you're still good, and you're still doing good. You're lavishing good on me. You are good. You intend good. The guidelines, the boundaries you set up in my life are for good. I didn't want to see that. I chose to ignore it. But now I get it. They were good all along. And I want to take advantage of the heart change that you offer and align myself with what's good. Align myself with who's good. See, that's what confession is. Here's what's true. Here's how I got it wrong. And here's what I know needs to happen next. David, God, you love me. You placed me in a position of authority. You used me in ministry. And foolishly, I wanted more. David, in his confession, dig into Psalms. David, after a year, finally gets around to saying, God, I wanted more. I decided you weren't enough. I stopped listening. I stopped caring. I stopped following. And I ended up in a world of hurt. I ended up adding sin to sin to sin to more sin. And the only thing I know to do now is to say, God, you are what is right. And you are who is good. And you are enough. And I want to come back. I need to leave my sin and I need to come back to the place I never should have left. One day Israel is going to confess that way. One day Israel is going to confess exactly the way that David confessed. Exactly the way that you and I confessed when we came to Christ for the first time. And if Israel has a regret on that day at the end of the tribulation, the only regret they're going to have is, why did we wait? Why did it take so long? Why didn't we see? Why couldn't we see? Why did we refuse to see? That's our only regret in coming to Christ ever, right? Have you ever heard anybody who says, wow, you know, I'm kind of sorry I became a Christian? No. The only regret I've ever heard anybody express is, I wish I had done it sooner. And that's the only regret that any of us have when we confess the sin that we still sin as Christians. Really confess it. Oh, good grief, why didn't I do this sooner? Why have I been choosing to keep a God who loves me at arm's length? Why have I continued to push him away by not acknowledging what deep down I've known all along is true, that he's good and I'm the one who's messed up? Why do we push God away? Why do we resist confession? Why do we go so long in the wilderness? I think the answer is, maybe we don't know him as well as we think we do. Maybe we don't trust him as much as we say we do. maybe we don't really believe all of the things we tell other people about him, that he is good. How do we remedy that? How do we start believing the things we think? Maybe we go back to some of those hymns. Amazing Grace, is it? Why is it? That saved a wretch like me. Was I? What's a wretch anyway? Who was I? Right? And who am I? Great is your faithfulness. We sang that one. How so? In what ways is God faithful? Be thou my vision, Lord of my heart. Do I really want that? Do I really want God to govern my rising and my setting, my thoughts and my actions? Do I really want to hand over control? I surrender all. What does all mean? Come thou fount of every blessing. Is that true? Or are there some blessings that I need to look for elsewhere? Some blessings that I need to obtain for myself apart from God? You get the idea. Confession starts with him, verse 18. Confession starts with a declaration of who he is. And how we've fallen short, how we've denied that. And our intention to close that gap by his grace, to remedy that, to change our hearts and put right our thinking. If we get that right, if we get him right, everything else falls into place. If we get that right, we fall into place. That place of rest and hope and trust and peace. And joy that we look for so many places and find only in him. Father, thank you that you are good, and thank you that in your goodness you lavish grace upon us. We read yet another chapter of your judgment, and we rejoice that the judgment that we read about, the judgment that you describe here in graphic, vivid, horrific language, is the judgment you bore. The judgment that you willingly received on the cross. The judgment that you took on yourself so that we would not have to. So that we could meet you in grace and grace alone. Lord, teach us who you are and draw us back and again to the entirety, to the everythingness of you. That our rejoicing would be greater and our confession sweeter. As bold as it needs to be to put us in the place that you purchased for us, worshiping at your feet. Close in confession to our God.